headlines. Muslims in many countries celebrate Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses say he was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical care during his detention. And a proposal by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees to delegate some services to other UN bodies sparks outrage among Palestinians. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, and these are our top stories at this hour. Muslims in over a dozen countries are celebrating Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Thousands of Palestinians marked the Eid with congregational prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque following weeks of bloody crackdown by the Israeli military in Al-Quds. The occasion was also marked by communal prayers elsewhere, including in Turkey, Yemen, North African nations, and most Persian Gulf countries. Tens of thousands of faithful also gathered for prayers in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after the city's main mosque opened to the ritual for the first time since the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. Several countries, including Afghanistan, Mali, marked the Eid on Sunday. Muslims in other Islamic countries, including Iran and Iraq, are expected to mark the occasion on Tuesday. Journalists and researchers Said Mohsen Abbas says Eid al-Fitr is about much more than celebrating the end of the fasting month of Ramadan.
It's not a celebration that should be really, I think, taken simply as a joyous occasion in and of itself alone, because ultimately we know that on this day there are many oppressed around the world and there are people who are suffering at the same time. And it's a time when we have to share also, because in all the bounties that we receive from the divine, Muslims are encouraged not only to sort of spend on their own kith and kin, but also to the poor that perhaps surround them. And things like feeding others and serving others and being generous is equally as important as obviously creating happiness and joy for our own children and our own loved ones and family. There has to be a kind of a bigger purpose to it. And of course, nowhere more poignantly is that noted than, say, the oppressed people like the people in Palestine, for instance, today. I mean, how much will the Israelis be allowing them to live and peacefully and do those celebrations without the kind of persecution that's gone on? Yemen is the same. So my heart goes out on this Eid to those who celebrate Eid under clammy conditions, under bombing and various other oppressive conditions, as well as those who have a life of ease and perhaps can, those people should be sharing all the more with those who are suffering at this time.
The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses have told Press TV about his dire situation. They say Hamid Nouri, the retired employee, that is, of Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over allegations of human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen Khalq back in the 1980s. His family says his arrest was illegal. They accuse the Swedish judicial system of issuing an arrest warrant for him without an independent investigation and based on untrue claims by some people. Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials didn't allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nuri as baseless and described his trial as political show. The MKO is responsible for some 12,000 Iranian people and the killing of them, as well as some officials in the 1980s, including the country's then president and prime minister. Palestinians voice concern over what they see as a potentially devastating blow to the mission of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. The agency chief recently raised a proposal to delegate some services to other UN agencies. Palestinians are now warning of a plot to dismantle the body. The minister, Mohammad Shataya, says the plan would violate the UN resolutions that set up UNRWA. The agency was established in 1949 to assist Palestinians who were forced from their homes by Israelis. It has faced a funding crunch for years, regularly falling tens of millions of dollars short of its stated needs. A human rights monitor says UNRWA is a reminder that the international community has a responsibility to solve the issue of Palestinian refugees. Earlier, we talked to Dawood Kutab, an award-winning Palestinian journalist, to get his insight on a proposal by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, to delegate some of its services to other bodies.
The timing of this plan and statements are very worrisome, because it comes on the eve of a renewal of the mandate of UNRWA. And so there is a lot of suspicion that it's not a mistake or a misstatement. Well, UNRWA has been a very important element to the refugee issue and to the right of return. And their mandate is very clear. It's very separate from all other UN agencies. And I think attempts to outsource some of its activities without clear guidelines, and that this is part of UNRWA's mandate, is very worrisome, and I think there are reasons why people are worried about it.
A Ukrainian official says Russia resumed shelling of a plant in the besieged city of Mariupol after nearly 100 people were evacuated from the site. An aide to Mariupol's mayor says the shelling took place on Sunday as soon as buses carrying evacuees left Azovstal Steelworks. It comes as Ukrainian authorities are planning to evacuate more civilians from the steel plant on Monday. The steel plant is the last Ukrainian stronghold in Mariupol. Russia has recently declared victory in the city as it is advancing in eastern and southern Ukraine. Kiev has asked Western countries to deliver more heavy weapons to counter Russia. New data shows Russian gas deliveries to Europe through Ukraine has hit a five-month high despite tensions over the war in Ukraine. According to the data by the transmission system operator in Slovakia, imports of Russian gas via the Nord Stream 1 to Germany also showed an increase on Monday. This is while EU energy ministers are holding an emergency meeting to discuss a Russian threat of halting natural gas exports unless European countries make their payments in rubles. Some EU diplomats have been quoted as saying that the bloc is leaning towards a ban on Russian oil imports by the end of the year, but may spare Hungary and Slovakia from the embargo. Germany, the top buyer of Russian energy, now says it will be able to withstand an EU embargo. The bloc imports 40% of its natural gas and 26% of its needed crude oil from Russia. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has paid an unannounced visit to Kiev in the latest show of support for Ukraine in its fight against Russia by a senior Western politician. The U.S. and its allies have supplied significant quantities of arms to Kiev and imposed economic sanctions on Russia, but such approaches were not only unhelpful to put an end, that is, the war, but rather have been putting fuel to the fire.
Leading a congressional delegation, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has paid a visit to Ukraine. Pelosi, who is the highest-ranking American leader to visit Ukraine since the start of the war, has reiterated Washington's support for Ukraine. During a meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, she vowed that the U.S. would stand by Ukraine until the end of the war with Russia.
We believe that we are visiting you to say thank you for your fight for freedom, that we are on a frontier of freedom, and that your fight is a fight for everyone. And so our commitment is to be there for you until the fight is done.
The United States is in an explicit war to weaken Russia and to defeat Russia, to help Ukrainian government defeat Russia in Ukraine. And it's, you know, Zelensky is really is someone who isn't making the decisions here. He's not going to be allowed to make a deal unless the United States lets him, and unless the right-wing forces in Ukraine let him.
Zelensky, for his part, thanked the U.S. and its Congress for, in his own words, the powerful signal of support. Pelosi's visit comes as the U.S. and its allies are stepping up to provide long-term support to Ukraine as the fighting rages on. Later in a statement, Pelosi said Russian President Vladimir Putin's, quote, diabolic invasion had taken a devastating human toll on Ukrainians. She also pledged imminent additional American support for Ukraine. The U.S. has already committed $4.3 billion to Kyiv in military support since 2021. Now, in a major increase of such funding, U.S. President Joe Biden has called on Congress to provide another $33 billion in emergency funding for Ukraine, including $20 billion for military aid. Moscow has warned that the aid would only fuel the conflict. Also, last week, responding to pleas from Zelensky, a group of 40 nations gathered by the U.S. in Germany agreed to streamline and expedite the delivery of weapons to Ukraine. Western nations have imposed broad economic sanctions on Russia and have been shipping increasing quantities of weapons to confront Russian forces. The Western intervention could lead to Russia's military response and raise the risk of confrontation between Russia and NATO, as well as a nuclear conflict. Some experts believe Washington's war aims had broadened from helping Ukraine to defend itself to damaging Russia itself. This notion supports the Russian narrative that Moscow's actions in Ukraine are to defend itself against NATO.
Russia, meanwhile, has hit a U.S. weapons warehouse at an airfield near Odessa, which also housed Western supplied arms and ammunition. At the same time, it is threatening to retaliate if other countries target its soil. These developments show there is no end in sight to the war. This also, as Russia and Ukraine have failed to reach a consensus in their peace talks.
U.S. President Joe Biden has proposed a $33 billion package for arming and supporting Ukraine. He also outlined proposed new laws to transfer the frozen assets of Russia's elite to Ukraine. The proposal is part of U.S. policies to ratchet up economic pressure on Russia over the Ukraine war. On the other hand, Moscow has warned that it may seize the Russian-based assets of countries it considers hostile. The Speaker of Russia's lower house of parliament says the proceeds from the sale of these assets will be used for the country's development. Vyacheslav Volodin accused some countries of violating international law and resorting to pure theft. He particularly named Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, and even the United States. Volodin said the U.S. has set a dangerous precedent that could backfire. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry said on Sunday it had carried out a missile strike on a military airfield near the port city of Odessa, destroying a runway and a hangar containing weapons and ammunition supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. and European countries. That's after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned that any shipment of weapons by NATO into Ukraine would be a legitimate target for Russia. Lavrov had also blamed Ukraine for the current impasse in the peace talks, accusing Kyiv of a desire to play games. He said the negotiations could have produced results if it was not for the interference of the United States and Britain.
Are they willing to go all in a war against Russia here? they are going to have to put massive amounts of weaponry in, and the Russians are going to try to prevent that. So we are in a very dangerous place where there's a significant possibility of not only a regional, but a world war.
Moscow has also blasted the West for encouraging Ukraine to strike Russia. That's after UK Defense Minister Ben Wallace said Ukraine has the right to strike military targets inside Russia. Meanwhile, the Russian President Vladimir Putin said earlier that any country deemed to be interfering in Ukraine would meet a lightning-fast response using weapons.
The Israeli spyware Pegasus is in controversy again. Spain says it has detected the malware in the mobile phones of Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez and Defense Minister Margarita Robles. The minister for the presidency says that the phones of the two top executives were infected in mid-2021. The official added that the government is certain about external involvement, but did not specify the place of its origin. The Justice Ministry has been asked to launch an invasion. The new revelation comes just weeks after the leader of Catalonia accused the central government of spying on a region on the region using Pegasus following a failed 2017 referendum there. A rights group then reported that phones of dozens of pro-independence Catalan figures were infected with the spyware and blamed on authorities in Madrid. The Pegasus malware was made by an Israeli firm. Moving on, Tunisia's President Kais Saied rules out the participation of critical opposition groups in a so-called national dialogue aimed at resolving the country's political crisis. Saied says a commission would manage the national dialogue on reforms. The proposed talks will include four major organizations. But Saied says those who, quote, sabotage, strafed, and mistreated the people will not be taking part. The main political party, which has been critical of Saied's controversial power grab last year, is also excluded from this list. Saied has noted that a high committee writing a constitution for a new republic would conclude its work within a few days. It will then be put to a referendum in late July, followed by legislative elections in December. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Someone in the United States dies of this largely preventable disease about every 4 minutes, equivalent to a deadly disaster on the scale of the 9/11 attacks every 8 or 9 days. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan writers. This article is published under the heading, The Dire Consequences of the U.S. Neglecting the Ongoing Pandemic. Here's the story. Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Biden's chief medical advisor, told the PBS NewsHour this week, "We are certainly right now in this country out of the pandemic phase. Not all experts agree." With all due respect to Dr. Fauci, many experts think Americans are still very much in a pandemic in the United States of America. Dr. Jonathan Rayner of George Washington School of Medicine told CNN, adding, "Cases have risen in the United States over 60%. Currently, there are 15,000 people hospitalized in the United States with COVID-19, and that number has risen by almost 2,000 people over the last couple of weeks. And because hospitalizations are rising, Americans will soon see deaths rising." Dr. Fauci did announce he would not be attending the White House Correspondents' Association dinner recently. "I am 81 years old, and if I get infected, I have a much higher risk," he told CNN. "It is predicted that by Memorial Day, 1 million Americans will have died of COVID-19, almost certainly an undercount." Fauci also acknowledged, "If you look at the global situation, there is no doubt this pandemic is still ongoing." The Biden administration is at an impasse with Congress over emergency funds to confront the pandemic. Biden's $22.5 billion request for COVID funding was stripped out of the $1.5 trillion appropriation bill that passed in mid-March. A partial funding agreement is back on the table, but it eliminates the $5 billion Biden requested for global vaccination efforts. Dr. Ashish Jha, the new White House COVID response coordinator, said at a news briefing recently, "So far, Congress has not stepped up to provide the funds that are needed for our most urgent needs. Among those needs are the purchase of millions of doses of COVID-19 vaccines to provide initial shots and boosters in preparation for a potential surge this coming fall, and development of a new generation of vaccines that could potentially protect against multiple new variants. Expanding availability of antiviral pill is another major unfunded priority, as is the provision of some vaccines, antibody treatment that can be taken in advance by immunocompromised people to shield them from infection." Another White House funding priority is the distribution of vaccines globally. "We've got to get the resources we need to get shots in arms so we can actually vaccinate the world and help bring this pandemic to a close," Jha said at a news briefing recently. "At the moment, the U.S. government has no money allocated for this. To date, the United States has delivered 500 million vaccine doses to 114 countries. Dr. John Nkosazana, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, credits the U.S. effort but says much more needs to be done. A A recent study by the Kaiser Family Foundation highlights COVID's ongoing threat in the United States of America, especially for the unvaccinated. The report states approximately 234,000 deaths since June 2021 could have been prevented with primary series vaccination. These vaccine-preventable deaths represent a quarter of nearly 1 million COVID-19 deaths since the pandemic began. Kaiser also reports that in January 2022, COVID-19 was the single greatest cause of death in the U.S. for those aged 45 to 84, and the fourth greatest cause of death overall. Someone in the United States dies of this largely preventable disease about every 4 minutes, equivalent to a deadly disaster on the scale of the 9/11 attacks every 8 to 9 days. The WHO's target of vaccinating 70% of the population in poor and developing nations by the end of June 2022 is not going to be met, in part due to the U.S. government's elimination of funding for the effort. This could very well lead to the emergence of new, potentially more transmissible and deadlier coronavirus variants. In the globalized world, these threats need to be met with a global response. As drug manufacturers make record profits, ensuring vaccine access around the world is not only a moral imperative, but a practical, achievable goal that protects us all.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. As mentioned earlier, we are presently focusing on the third sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about the wisdom behind his governance. We also talked about the type of justice system that Imam Ali alayhi salam was proposing, and how after Imam Ali alayhi salam, this system got faded away completely, and the leaders who came after Imam Ali brainwashed the communities and made them forget that justice, such that now that system of justice just looked like a fable. And the people no longer worked hard or struggled to try and achieve that system. And they just thought that it's a utopian, you know, dream and not a reality. And this was the situation that happened after that. But of course, Islam is that type of religion, has that system that can, you know, bring about that special and, you know, wonderful justice system that is good for the society. As mentioned earlier, we also mentioned about the fact that Uthman, or the third caliph, due to certain reasons, ended up doing actions that were unjust, basically, and the people were tired. Even according to some narrations, even the wife of the Prophet, Aisha, she was also tired and frustrated, and she had mentioned a few things, inshallah, that we shall mention in the coming segment.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were discussing about the fact that Imam Ali alayhi salam came at a time where people were frustrated and they were tired of the fact that they did not see justice in the third caliph's government, because they had witnessed the prophetic justice, and therefore for them it was very difficult to face this level of injustice. Such that even the wife of the Prophet Aisha, she mentioned in one of the narrations we have, for example, by Ibn Abi al-Hadid, who is a Sunni narrator, who is a Sunni scholar, who has explained and has footnotes and exegesis on Nahjul Balagha. He mentions in the 20th volume, on page number 22, he says that he quotes from Aisha, who mentions and says, "Uqtulu Na'thalan qatalahu Allah." That means that kill this Na'thal. May Allah punish him. May Allah, kill him. Imagine that Aisha compares him to Na'thal, who was a very evil person. And she compares it to him, and she even says that may Allah kill him. To that degree, people were frustrated. But of course, that doesn't mean that you take the law in your own hands and you kill a person. That was not right. And that is why Imam Ali protected Uthman, because he didn't want people to take the law in their own hands, because that would destroy the general order and discipline in the Islamic government. It was even more dangerous. And that is why we noticed that this issue of killing Uthman and the third caliph was not a good thing. It was bad for the community, for the Islamic Ummah. And even after Uthman died, people made use of the death of Uthman to combat Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imagine, Imam Ali alayhi salam was the one who protected Uthman. He is the one who sent his own family and children to go and protect Uthman. But at the end of the day, these same people who commanded others to kill Uthman, they come up and turn the tables on Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they accuse him of the murder of Uthman. You can see that this was just a political game. And killing people, killing such a person, was actually a big, big mistake. And Imam Ali alayhi salam kind of knew that this would happen. And that is why he tried his best to protect the third caliph at that time.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. We are now discussing about the fact that there was an error that was performed, and a big mistake by the Muslim Ummah, by killing Uthman, the third caliph. After him, his killing, which was not performed in a judicial way, because even if someone is unjust or is performing some crimes, the best method is to take him to the court of law. And Islam has a system that even a leader can be taken to the court of law. Imam Ali alayhi salam himself has gone to the court of law. Someone accused him that he had taken away his shield or something similar to that, or his armor. And Imam Ali alayhi salam went to the court. This was how it was. I mean, you can even take the leader to the court in Islam. So it was very easy to take Uthman, the third caliph, to the court and sort out the issue. But unfortunately, people didn't do that. And there was a political game played there, that people made use of Uthman. Even after his death, after he died, they accused Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they waged wars against him. The first war, the second war, as you know, the war of Jamal, the war that came after that, the Siffin war, and all the other wars that followed. So Imam Ali alayhi salam suffered a lot in that sense. But he, of course, in the eyes of Allah, he was in the presence of God and doing his duty. In that sense, he was always happy. His heart was always content. It was always effulgent. But his sadness was that the people were losing out on the teachings of Islam. And so the story goes on. The story is a very sad story. It's a heart-rending story that if a person reads the history and reads Imam Ali alayhi salam's life and how he sacrificed himself in the various times to help Islam, and what the Ummah did after that, and how much ingratitude they showed to him and his children and his grandchildren, really that would bring tears in the eyes. But of course, today is a happy day. In some places, it's the day of Eid. It is a time for us to remember each other in prayers and to rejoice the great blessings that we had in the month of Ramadan, where Allah gave us the opportunity to fast and express our love and obedience to Him. Let us pray to Allah that He accepts our deeds in this holy month. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد ممجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Global capitalism is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic with more inequality, more authoritarianism, more militarization, and more civic and political strife. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by William I. Robinson, author. This article is published under the heading, Global Capitalism Has Become Dependent on War-Making to Sustain Itself. This is the second part of the article. By 2018, private for-profit military companies employed some 15 million people around the world, while another 20 million people worked in private security worldwide. The private security policing business is one of the fastest-growing economic sectors in many countries and has come to dwarf public security around the world. The amount spent on private security in 2003, the year of the invasion of Iraq, was 73% higher than that spent in the public sphere. And three times as many persons were employed in private forces as in official law enforcement agencies. In half of the world's countries, private security agents outnumber police officers. These corporate soldiers and police were deployed to guard corporate property, provide personal security for executives and their families, collect data, conduct police, paramilitary, counterinsurgency, and surveillance operations, carry out mass crowd control and repression of protesters, run private detention and interrogation facilities, manage prisons, and participate in outright warfare. Now, these same private military and security firms are pouring into Ukraine, with some mercenary companies offering between $1,000 and $2,000 a day for those with combat experience. The fact that this explosion in spending coincides perfectly with continued worldwide stagnation following the Great Recession suggests that the heightened militarization of the global economy is as much or more a response to this chronic stagnation than to perceived security threats. If bursts of militarized accumulation, such as that unleashed by 9/11, then by the 2008 financial collapse, and now, by the crisis in Eastern Europe, help offset the over-accumulation crisis further into the future, they are also high-risk bets that heighten worldwide tensions and push the world dangerously towards all-out international conflagration. This crisis of global capitalism is economic or structural, one of the chronic stagnation in the global economy, but it is also political, a crisis of state legitimacy and capitalist hegemony. The system is moving towards a general crisis of capitalist rule as billions of people around the world face uncertain struggles for survival and question a system they no longer see as legitimate. Historically, wars have pulled the capitalist system out of crisis while they serve to deflect attention from political tensions and problems of legitimacy. Economically, global capitalism faces what is known in technical language as overaccumulation, a situation in which the economy has produced or has the capacity to produce great quantities of wealth, but the market cannot absorb this wealth because of escalating inequality. Capitalism, by its very nature, will produce abundant wealth, yet polarize that wealth and generate ever greater levels of social inequality unless offset by redistributive policies. The level of global social polarization and inequality now experienced is without precedent. In 2018, the richest 1% of humanity controlled more than half of the world's wealth, while the bottom 80% had to make do with just 5%. The International Development Agency Oxfam reported in January that during the first 2 years of the coronavirus pandemic, the 10 richest men in the world more than doubled their fortunes from $700 billion to $1.5 trillion, while 99% of humanity saw a fall in their income and 160 million more people fell into poverty. Such inequalities end up undermining the stability of the system as the gap grows between what is or could be produced and what the market can absorb. The extreme concentration of the planet's wealth in the hands of the few and the accelerated impoverishment and dispossession of the majority means that the transnational capitalist class, or TCC, has increasing difficulty in finding productive outlets to upload enormous amounts of surplus it accumulated. In the years leading up to the pandemic, there was a steady rise in the underutilized capacity and slowdown in industrial production around the world. The surplus of accumulated capital with nowhere to go expanded rapidly. Transnational corporations recorded record profits during the 2010s at the same time that corporate investment declined. Along with militarized accumulation, the TCC has turned to unprecedented levels of financial speculation and to debt-driven growth to sustain profit-making in the face of the crisis. If left unchecked, overaccumulation results in crisis, in a stagnation, recessions, depression, social upheavals, and war. Just what people are experiencing right now. But there is a related dynamic at work in the global war economy. The need for dominant groups to suppress mass discontent and deflect the crisis of state legitimacy. International frictions escalate as states, in their effort to retain legitimacy, seek to sublimate social and political tensions and to keep the social order from fracturing. All around the world, a people's spring has taken off. From Chile to India, France to US, Haiti to Nigeria, South Africa to Colombia, Jordan to Sri Lanka, waves of strikes and mass protests have proliferated and in some instances appear to be acquiring an anti-capitalist character. Wars and external enemies allow the ruling groups to deflect attention away from domestic melee in their effort to maintain a grip on power as the crisis deepens. In the US, this sublimation has involved efforts to channel social unrest towards scapegoated communities such as immigrants or other marginalized groups. This is one key function of racism and was a core component of the Trump administration's political strategy, or towards an external enemy, which had clearly become a cornerstone of the Biden government's strategy well before the crisis in Eastern Europe. U.S. presidents historically reach their highest approval ratings when they launch wars. George W. Bush reached an all-time high of 90% in 2001 as his administration geared up to invade Afghanistan, and his father, George H. W. Bush, achieved an 89% approval rating in 1991. Right as the U.S. declared the end of its first invasion of Iraq and the liberation of Kuwait. It is unlikely that an increasing militarization of the world economy can, in the long run, offset either the economic or the political dimensions of the crisis of global capitalism. Global capitalism is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic with more inequality, more authoritarianism, more militarization, and more civic and political strife. In the U.S., the class struggle is heating up with a wave of strikes and of unionization drives in Amazon, Starbucks, and elsewhere in the gig economy. The current inflationary spiral and the escalation of the class struggle in the United States and around the world point to the inability of the ruling groups to contain the expanding crisis. The drive by the capitalist state to externalize the political fallout of the crisis increases the danger that international tensions and localized conflicts will snowball into broader international conflagrations of unforeseen consequences.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we would like to offer our congratulations to our esteemed listeners, because in many countries in the Islamic world and the non-Islamic world, today is the day of Eid al-Fitr, which is one of the most happiest holidays in the Muslim calendar. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith and tradition, which has been narrated in the book Nahjul Balagha, a very famous book, which contains the sermons and letters and aphorisms of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And this is the 428th aphorism which has been narrated in that book. In this hadith, in this tradition, the Imam alayhi salam, he mentions Eid, and he talks a little bit about it. Let's see what he says. The Imam says, this Eid, meaning this holiday, this festival of Eid al-Fitr, is truly only a happy day, is truly only a holiday and a festival for the person whose fastings have been accepted. لِمَنْ قَبِلَ اللَّهُ صِيَامَهُ. Right? For the person who fasted in the month of Ramadan, and not only fasted in the month of Ramadan, but Allah accepted his fast. So it's not simply the Eid and the festival for the person who fasted. A lot of times, right, on this day, we feel very happy, we feel very satisfied and delighted that the month of Ramadan is finished and our fasting is completed. And, you know, we were able to perform all the fasts in the month of Ramadan. But the Imam says, this is not enough. It's not enough that we fasted for us to be happy on this day. Rather, we should be sure that Allah accepted our fast. Of course, we can never be truly sure that Allah accepted our acts of obedience, such as our fasting or not. But we should at least do everything that has been prescribed and has been set out as a condition for the acceptance of this, of these acts of obedience, such as fasting, right? And then leave the rest to Allah and hope that He accepts it. And this is goes back to two very important principles in Islamic ethics, which is fear and hope, right? The mu'min, the believer, is always between fear and hope. These are the two wings of the believer, as it has been described in the hadith, which take him towards the proximity of Allah, fear and hope, or hope and desire. In continuation, the Imam says, he said that the Eid is truly only a holiday, is only a festival for the person whose fasts were accepted. And he says, and whose night worship and whose worship that he performed in the night, who's standing up in the night for prayer, has been appreciated and accepted by God. This is the person who can truly enjoy Eid and consider it a festival and a holiday for himself. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at Eid and it being a festival for the person whose acts of obedience were accepted. In the words of Imam Ali, we once again congratulate you on this most auspicious day. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.